You're listening to the Wordslinger Podcast, episode 100, The Existence of David Brin. This episode of the Wordslinger Podcast is brought to you by the audiobook edition of Coelho Medallion. You can find Coelho Medallion on Audible and use your Audible credit, or get Coelho Medallion for free when you go to audibletrial.com/wordslinger.
It's the Wordslinger Podcast, where story matters. Build your brand, write your book, redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours? Now, here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Wordslinger.
Wordslinger.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin Tomlinson, the Wordslinger, and this is a very special 100th episode of the Wordslinger Podcast. I could not be more excited about this, actually, and if I sound a little muffled, quiet, raspy, it's only because we're actually in Florida right now. We're in Naples, Florida, home to a lot of really wealthy people, we've discovered, and it's a beautiful place. We're in a RV resort called Crystal Lake RV Resort, and it's beautiful here. We've been here for a few days now. Took 3 days to drive in from the Houston, Texas area, and we've been hanging out with family for the past 2 or 3 days here. And the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S., if you're a non-U.S. listener, we get the Thanksgiving holiday coming up. When you're listening to this, it will have already passed. But for me, it's coming up, I believe, tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. Things are a little off track for me right now. But I am currently recording a few feet away from my lovely, beautiful, sleeping wife. So I'm trying to keep things kind of low-key, which is a little difficult because this is number 100. This is the 100th episode of the Wordslinger Podcast. And that's something I need to just, you know, pop some fireworks over or something. So kind of restraining myself. So in lieu of fireworks, I do have something really cool and really explosive to me anyway. Now, if you are an avid reader, if you're especially an avid science fiction reader, you will recognize the name David Brin. He is he's a science fiction author primarily. He's written a lot of nonfiction as well, but now, where I was first introduced to him was his book, The Postman, which I actually read. You may have heard of The Postman. It was turned into a film by Kevin Costner. And I actually read the book well before the film was made and really, truly loved it. Now, I'm a fan of post-apocalyptic fiction. I'm just going to put that out there. And my wife is too, actually. But when The Postman came out in paperback, you know, I had not had a lot of experience with post-apocalyptic fiction. So it was one of the first I'd read, and I just really enjoyed the book. And it had some odd quirks here and there, but it was extremely well done. And I think it was an interesting glimpse into what the future could hold in the event of something catastrophic. And I found it to be a very hopeful book. So now, the film I also enjoyed, and I enjoyed it in a completely separate way. And talking to David Brin in this episode, you find out that he had his own experiences with it. I think, in general, it seems he liked the film. As he put it, the director, Kevin Costner, actually kept the heart of the film but lost the brains, in David Brin's estimate. So that'll be left to you to decide. I highly recommend comparing the two. I think they both stand well alone, independent of each other. They're similar stories, but they're not the same identical story. I think you can enjoy both equally. So go check it out. And of course, as Brin points out, you know, Costner he's great with the camera. He's great at capturing this gorgeous landscape and this, you know, making the world look absolutely amazing. So it's great from a cinematography standpoint. So go check that out if you haven't already. So beyond that, this interview has a lot of great insights from somebody who's been in the business for a very long time. If you're an author, especially if you're just starting out, I love to find these gems of wisdom and sit at the feet of the masters, as it were, and just sort of learn. There were some surprises for me in this interview. As longtime listeners know, I'm a big fan of Orson Scott Card. Ender's Game was the book that launched my writing career. It nudged me into thinking of myself as a writer and author. So I have a special place in my heart for that author and those books. And David Brenda has his own opinions. So, which is wonderful, though. And it gives you new perspectives. Actually, he said something in this interview about Orson Scott Card and his work I had not yet considered. So now I can look at all of that work in a new light. So that's what this is about. It's all about the story, right? So thank you so much for tuning in for this very special 100th episode of the Wordslinger Podcast. I'm not going to keep you from Mr. Brin any longer. We're going to roll right into that interview. Please stick around afterward for, general housekeeping, quick wrap-up, and that sort of thing. And I just want to mention before the podcast that this one is especially being brought to you by not only my book, Coelho Medallion on Audible, but also by Draft Digital. Where if you are an author, you can actually get your book converted into ebook format and distributed to storefronts worldwide. It's a wonderful resource for authors. I hope you'll check it out. So that said, let's get to this amazing, incredible interview with David Brin. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. And, this is going to be, I can already tell this is going to be one of my favorite episodes of all time. I've interviewed some fantastic and amazing authors in the past, and this particular author is somebody who had a huge influence on my own writing early on. And that is David Brin, who is a science fiction author. He's a New York Times bestseller. He's a Hugo Award-winning author. More credits than I can probably read off, actually, David. So I really appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, no, sure. It's, it's anything to have a distraction this week.
And for those listening, and this is going to air not too long from record date, but this is election week. We just got our results, and it's an interesting time to live in. We're just going to put it like that. Could this very well be the events that sparked everything that happened in The Postman?
People have actually been writing to me more and more about The Postman lately. I was just invited up to Corvallis, which in the novel is the center of human civilization.
Right.
And I did a reading from the book, and they were very proud to be portrayed as the people who were resisting the rise of feudalism in this post-apocalyptic world that Kevin Costner, shall we say, successfully portrayed the heart while scooping out and throwing away all of the brains. So.
Okay, so since we've already gotten to the topic, that is something I want to talk to you about, because I will say this, and I think you actually shared something with me along these lines. But I mean, I actually enjoyed. I read the book way back when it came out in '85. I probably read it around that time, maybe a little later. I was a little young in '85, but the film also kind of resonated with me on two very different notes, but I liked both. But you have apparently a story, behind the scenes story of this film being made, right?
Well, I don't have an awful lot of stories from the set, because I visited once, and Costner pretty much snubbed me. When you're dealing with media doing versions of your work, you have to basically have a balance scale, whether it balanced out all right. I mean, not everybody does super well the way my friend Ted Chiang did with his new movie, The Arrival,
right?
Which is very good, and they treated him very well, and he's extremely happy. In my case, the director was a dick to me. On the other hand, the people he got rid of who had the property before him were far worse.
Oh.
And he replaced an evil screenwriter with with a good one who he kind of messed up. So the last third of the movie is an incoherent mishmash, and that helped to make it be a failure. And also he released it on the same week as Titanic. This was smart.
Oh, man.
This was brilliant. on the other hand, you know, the fact of the matter is that Kevin Costner is, in my opinion, one of the greatest cinematographers of our era.
Yeah.
This movie is probably one of the dozen or so most beautiful visually and musically ever filmed. And I'm proud to be associated with that. The thing that made the biggest difference was the fact that even though he scooped out and threw away all my brains from my book, nevertheless, the heart of the book was very well taken care of. The heart message of the story that post-apocalyptic a hero is not going to defeat the villains single-handedly.
Right.
The main role of a hero is to remind people that they are heroes.
Right.
That your neighbors, that the villagers in such a world only need to be reminded that they were once sacred beings called citizens.
Yeah.
And they'll take care of the rest. And the story is about a guy who doesn't think much of himself, actually despises himself as a liar, but the lie he tells spreads and becomes true. So, you know, it's in 25 languages, and of all the books, you know, that if you're not big into science fiction, that one, nevertheless, I promise, I give people a money back guarantee. But the capper that made me decide to, you know, it was all basically a pretty good experience, is that Costner gave me something to say to people in airports.
Oh, okay.
And on airplanes.
Always handy.
You know, it's very handy.
Yeah.
You know that movie that wasn't a success? Well, you know, it's the book's better. But and you have to try to be cheerful in life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the fact that he didn't betray the heart and soul of my story makes this a plus. It's a win-win, and I'm certainly willing to work with other people. You know, there's things get optioned from now and then. I mean, what better elevator pitch could there be for a movie in this day and age than, hey, JB, get this, dolphins in space.
Right.
Dolphins in space.
It's a surefire hit. It's a nailed down winner.
One would think.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, I was actually just going to ask how did this affect sales of the book and the rest of the impact on your work? How did this come about?
Oh well, I didn't impact my work very much. I moved on to things. The sales hit boost that it gave was not very, very much because it was a flop.
Right. That's where I was going with that. I've talked to other authors who've had adaptations, and some of them lament that, the flop movie kind of ruined the book or ruined book sales.
Oh, nonsense. The book is there. The book is what it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a separate thing, and you have to look at it that way.
Yeah.
No, I had a movie. Oh boy. It's fine.
I will say that, as adaptations go, I've seen far worse. I mean, Stephen Gould's Jumper was not adapted very well, and, it shows. Even Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game wasn't adapted very well.
Well, you're talking about books at two ends of my personal spectrum.
Yeah.
I think it's a tragedy for our civilization, and it's reflected in the elections, perhaps, that Ender's Game became the cult classic that it is, because I consider the film, the story to be, spectacularly evil.
Oh.
And it's the whole notion of the demigod. You cannot see a single Orson Scott Card story that does not preach that democracy is hopeless, that your neighbors are fools. That's the opposite of the postman.
Yeah.
Your neighbors are fooled, fools. Democracy is hopeless. Forget an intelligent human civilization. It's not possible. Your only hope is to pray for the arrival of a savior demigod. And once you realize that that's the theme in every single one of his stories.
Yeah.
You start realizing that the guy is not on our side. But then again, that is the lesson of Star Wars.
Right.
That's why I wrote That's why I wrote the an article in Salon magazine that was one of their top viewed ever, comparing Star Wars to Star Trek, and it led to a book called Star Wars on Trial, which right. in which I'm the prosecuting attorney, and one of Lucas's novelizers, Matt Stover, is the defense attorney, and we call witnesses, intellectuals and philosophers and science fiction authors as witnesses pro and against seven charges against Lucas. And it is so much fun.
Yeah.
We snap our suspenders and protest to the robot judge and get fined and cross-examine the witnesses. And it's just huge fun. And I had one of my favorite covers. We couldn't use on the covers because it's completely unauthorized, any Lucasian characters. Okay. And his characters. So in the courtroom with a nondescript, non-Lucas robot judge, sitting in the witness chair is George freaking Lucas. Because he's a public figure, you see. And so we had no problem using him.
Yeah.
So it's one of the best covers I've ever had.
That's really interesting. Okay, that gives me I have lots of thoughts about that. But you've written actually Star Trek, at least Star Trek. You've written Star Wars books too, I think, right? But you've at least written Star Trek.
No, I wrote a Star Trek graphic novel.
Oh yeah.
Based on a story that I thought of in 1965, watching the original series first run.
Yeah.
And as a 14-year-old, I sent the idea to Paramount, and they sent back what I now know was the right thing, but though it hurt my feelings at the time, saying we cannot accept unsolicited suggestions.
Yeah.
So I vowed revenge, and 40 years later, I wrote a graphic novel brilliantly illustrated by Scott Hampton, telling the story of how the transporter was invented in the late 21st century, mm-hmm. and how the transporter inventor gets in a fight on the stage of this nuclear-powered transporter beam that he just invented with his enemy, and they both get hurled off into space. And the history shows that they were both killed, but 300 years later, the Enterprise happens to be 300 light years from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And they get in the middle of empty space, they get a transporter beam. So it turns into a fun story. The thing about writing science fiction is that you can vary what it's all about. And depending upon whether it's a short story, which usually doesn't have a third act, usually you suspend, you have a sense of suspended tension.
Mm-hmm.
A short story. Short stories are a lot like Twilight Zone episodes. You often don't find out what's happened. Instead, right. you're supposed to have this delicious tension,
right?
And not be able to speak for an hour after watching the Twilight Zone episode for the first time. That's what you get with short fiction, and I try to do that. I did win one Hugo for a short story. My latest book is is my third short story collection, and I think my best, called Insistence of Vision. Mm-hmm. It just came out. A novella is, I believe, the natural storytelling length for human beings. And the greatest novella storyteller ever was Poul Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
He won all of his Hugos and Nebulas based upon his novellas. And that's the length that a tribal storyteller would have told around the campfire.
Yeah.
To the tribe, putting them to sleep, and they would have gone to bed with vivid dreams. And the novel lets you truly expand upon your ideas.
Right.
And in some cases, like my novels, Earth and Existence, you're depicting a near future world in a great detail. you know, what might it actually be like? And some of my fans run a wiki tracking some of the predictions from Earth.
Right.
Like it had web pages before there was a web. It talked about, you know, wearing augmented reality glasses.
Right.
They were called TrueView goggles in those days. And cop cams. And people looking back at the cops. These were all there in that 1989 novel.
Hmm. And and all that stuff is in some version. You're seeing all that now. I noticed that too. I mean, that's very cool, and that makes you something of a futurist, I think, right? Or do you consider yourself a futurist?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what people call me. I give a lot of interviews, and I do a lot of public speaking lately. Yeah. It's been distracting from my writing. Just in the last 6 weeks, I've given speeches for Boeing's 100th anniversary, GE's big internal conference, IBM's giant extravaganza in Las Vegas, the World of Watson, Viacom. So, you know, there are a lot of people who want to have some idea what's going on, what's going to be coming. You know, I did two speeches for the CIA in the last year, and two at the – I'll tell you, one venue I'm not going to be probably invited back to for a while is I did two in the last 6 months at the White House. I'm not expecting.
You never know. You never know. Trump might like science fiction.
Gingrich likes science fiction. Gingrich wrote science fiction.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. But you see, you're assuming that Donald Trump reads.
Okay.
And Samantha Bee did a hilarious yet frightening compilation of evidence that he does not,
right?
That he cannot. And this is going to, if I have any kind of a prediction on the aftermath of this election, it's that Donald Trump is going to go into severe withdrawal from his addiction, and the addiction is those rallies.
Yeah.
He was living for them every single day. He would go out there to these rallies. And tens of thousands of raw-throated, you know, cheering people who would cheer at the most outrageous things he says, and working with reports in the White House is not going to be easy for him. And I predict he's going to find some excuse to go back on the trail for rallies.
Right.
And that is
fraught with danger. Potential danger.
Well, it's going to be very, very interesting.
Yeah. So I have to say I've always been interested in this notion of science fiction somehow. Maybe it's more than just predicting. Maybe it's influencing future, especially technology. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that it has that kind of impact?
Well, I have an essay online people can look up, David Brin's Self-Preventing Prophecies.
Okay.
or My Name and Orwell, where I point out that, you know, the most powerful science fiction has always been those novels or movies or stories that prevent the very failure mode that they explore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if people looked at Orson Scott Card's stories as being disastrous, you know, examples of society being foolish and handing their fate over to demigods, then he would be a positive influence. But the best example would be 1984 by Orwell,
right.
In which millions and millions of people felt girded to resist the notion of Big Brother.
Yeah.
And the difference between a decent Democrat and a decent Republican, of course, this is back in the days when we weren't in the state of civil war, is who you think is trying to become Big Brother.
Right.
The Republican, rightfully to some degree, was afraid of snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. And the Democrat is afraid of conniving aristocrats and faceless corporations. Well, you know, when you put it that way, the proper answer is duh. And right. and those who have converted us from politics into civil war, because we no longer have politics, we have civil war. though they deliberately did that in order to distract us from that horizon of Big Brother. So that's an example of the self-preventing prophecy. Another would be Soylent Green, which recruited millions of environmentalists and predicted global warming back in 1979. Dr. Strangelove, retired military officers now admit that it probably saved all of our lives.
Yeah,
I'm not claiming that I've ever written a true self-preventing prophecy.
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, the one of the premises of Postman was about genetic warfare, basically, right? Like altering the human genome
and human augmentation, and also the notion of a rise of feudalism.
Yeah,
sure, but, you know, we'll see. I hope, you know, something only becomes self-preventing prophecy if you've managed to rail at something that becomes a very plausible danger.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So, all right, so, yeah, so, you know, you move on from there to other types of science fiction, you know, thought-provoking.
Yeah.
The thought-provoking kind. I mentioned Earth and Existence. Those are my two books, near future contemplations, that are books for grown-ups. And we did a trailer for Existence. You can look it up, my name and Existence. It's three gorgeous minutes, you know, of illustrations from the book by the great artist Patrick Farley. Mm-hmm. But I must admit, I had more fun writing Kiln People, because that's just sci-fi. That's real sci-fi,
right? Yeah.
Not trying to be too serious, although there are serious issues. But it's set in a future in which, you know, a busy person's dream comes true, in which you can be in more than two places at once at the same time.
Right.
You know, and that you'd get everything done. Right. So.
Yeah, that's it's intriguing. It's an intriguing idea. And you see it, you see that played out in other science fiction. I've seen that sort of thing before, but those are fun books. That's the kind of stuff I liked growing up, by the way. I loved finding gems like that.
They were entertaining. Yeah. Oh yeah, fun. Oh yeah. Well, fun is what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
I've haven't had as much lately. But in any event, what other topics? Well, you know, I've been doing an awful lot. I've been doing an awful lot of speaking and writing about transparency. You know, I alluded to how in Earth, you know, I predicted cop cams and people looking back at cops with cams.
Right.
And one of my complaints about the news media is that they ignored the fact that the 2013 was arguably the best year for civil liberties in the United States in at least in this century.
Right.
Because that's the year that the Obama administration and the courts agreed that citizens have a right to record their interactions with police.
Yes.
And that was extremely important, and it was predicted in my nonfiction book, The Transparent Society.
Yeah.
And if you happen to have a copy, those of you at home, look at page 160.
Everyone's flipping right now.
Yes, and as I lick my finger and wave it in the air, going ka-ching, one more. Okay.
You're going to have to break down for us, those of us who don't have the book right in front of us. What's on page 160?
Oh, well,
are you looking it up?
No, it's just predicting the standoff of cameras,
right,
and that cameras would wind up being what the Colt 45 supposedly was in the Wild West, and that's the great equalizer, only with this difference. You do a quick draw and shoot the wrong person with a camera, you can apologize.
Mm-hmm.
You do that with a gun, and they hang you.
Yeah. I do know, though, there is that argument that, like doctors, where they don't want cameras in the operating room because sometimes doctors have to make decisions that will look like mistakes, you know, and this open them up for liability, you know. Do you think something like that applies to the police? I know that was a concern.
Oh, no, it's a terrible concern. We are going to go through very many awkward phases.
Yeah.
And it surprises people to learn that I'm actually not in favor of immediately sharing all cop cam footage immediately. Even though what I describe is a secular trend toward a world in which that's inevitable.
Right.
Because right now we need the good cops to be our allies against the bad cops.
Right.
And we do not need them to be under a total stress. What we need them to be is accountable.
Right.
As long as the footage is always taken and those cops who turn off their cameras are punished, as long as the footage is always taken and it's always protected and it's always offered to defense attorneys and to supervisory boards and citizen boards, there's no reason it has to be released to the press and the public right away.
Right.
Give them some space, because the fact is that sooner or later the footage will come out.
Right.
I mean, if you know it's going to be released in 2 years, the cops are going to be just as much more careful.
Yeah.
Especially if they know that the defense attorneys get it right away.
Right.
So you're going to get the benefits without having to unnecessarily create these, potential lynch mobs of public opinion when they see something that is kind of iffy in the footage. So does that sound way too moderate and reasonable for a guy who's radical Mr. Transparency?
That's because
what we need to be is radically and militantly moderate.
Yeah.
That is what's different about our revolution from all other revolutions in the history of the world. And it's what made us more effective.
Right.
Made our revolution more effective. Because if you are radically and militantly radical, then that tips over into yet another form of feudalism. The feudalists just change their names. They're commissars. Mm-hmm. They're people's committees. What we have is a gradually, incrementally improving system, that's subject to accountability and the gradual ratcheting up of the morality of the people themselves.
Right.
And because it sounds like I'm saying words like gradual, and gradual is often too slow when it comes to things like equal rights. And because I use the word incremental, it sounds as if I'm pallid and milk toast and tepid. But I am ferociously and militantly a believer in this revolution.
Yeah.
It's the only one that ever worked. And in 100 years, we've accomplished more for humanity than all of the previous civilizations on all continents combined. And that is the methodology by which we did it. And then the whole point of the Transparent Society is that our methodology is called reciprocal accountability.
Yeah.
Because we're all delusional. That is the fundamental of human nature.
Right. That's all becoming ever more obvious on Facebook.
Yeah, well, the great human talent is delusion, and it leads to great art. If you buy my books, I promise to cater magical incantations to your delusional talent and make you feel that you are far away from wherever you are.
Well, that's what books tend to be, right? Like 300-page delusions.
I am better than most. I will give you sparks and explosions, deep human insights, kissy kissy love face. I'll give you, the whole damn thing while giving you facts and information between it, in small lumps.
Excellent.
I'm a master magician, and I cater to your delusions, and I will give you a good product, but you'll know that it's a delusion.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have parasites in our culture who cater to fostering delusional delusions, and this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. This is the stock and trade of all the Savonarolas, the Svengales, the Goebbels, the people who have gone all the way back for 6, 7, 8, 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem with delusion is that we hate the antidote. There is an antidote to delusion, and we hate it. It's called criticism.
Yeah.
because the guy across the table from you doesn't have the same delusions you have, you see.
Right.
Oh, well, except for during the electoral season, they probably gather in groups of people who share delusions, and that's a problem. Right. But if you are talking to somebody who doesn't share your delusions, that person will point out the errors in your delusions, and we hate that.
Yeah.
And I have just explained human history, because for thousands of years, we had these pyramid-shaped social orders of kings and lords and priests, and they would kill people who criticized them.
Right.
Because that's how you stay in power. That's how you keep your harem. And as a result, their delusions were never pointed out to them. And that explains why feudalism was such horrible government.
Right.
It was unalloyed litany of horrible delusional mistakes.
Yeah.
And for all the fact that we appear to have many, many delusions, the fact of the matter is we catch a higher ratio of them than any other civilization in history. It's just that sometimes we don't catch them as soon as we should.
Right. Yeah. I think we can all draw conclusions as to where that could go.
Yes.
Well, I hate doing this, but we have come up against the time, and I promised you I would keep this at around 30 minutes, and I'm going to keep that promise. But I got to tell you, I am very happy that you agreed to be on the show, even if you probably thought I was Rick Tomlinson. NASA.
these Tomlinson boys, yeah. They're just amazing.
He's like a cousin of mine or something. We he and I have had a couple of conversations about this in the past. I need to reach out. I need to get him on the show.
Get him to spit into a jar.
Yeah,
that's what Sergey Brin did. I was speaking at Google and he grabbed me, took me out to his Lexus parked on the street. And he pulled out this medicinal looking thing, opened it, and said, "Spit." So I got a free 23andMe membership back when it cost $1,000. That's all of having a fourth cousin who's a billionaire ever got me.
Okay.
So, I got a free and now it's $99.
Right.
Anybody can have one. But, all right. So I got something out of it, and I found out I'm the fourth cousin of a billionaire. That plus $3.65 will get me a small latte at Starbucks.
Exactly right. Yeah. I'm not exactly going to be boarding any rockets anytime soon.
Well, explain to your viewers what that what I was refering to. How our grandfathers used to say that and a nickel would get me a cup of coffee.
Right.
I know the mayor.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah. Now Elon answers my emails.
Really?
So.
Well, then I need to go through you to get him on the show then.
I want it to stay that way. So
yeah,
I'm very
exactly.
Careful.
No, I know. I would actually. He is. He's on my. I guess I have a bucket list of folks I'd like to meet. He's definitely one of them. I hear he's kind of rough on folks, but I'd be willing to risk it.
Look, he's a lot nicer than Edison was, and Edison changed the world.
Well, exactly right. Now
the world should only change the way Elon Musk wants it to change.
Exactly. Well, heck yeah, man. That guy's trying to get us on the surface of Mars and spread us around.
It's the near term things that astonish me. Even if Tesla goes belly up next year.
Yeah. The developments.
He changed the world. He scared everybody into following his lead.
Yes. Yeah.
And the same was true with solar, and the same is true in the people who are using their own money to develop hyperloops. No, if I sound like an egotist who thinks he's the smartest person in a lot of rooms, I am an egotist who loves being in a room with smarter people.
Yes.
And when I'm in a room with Elon, I'm in a room with someone a lot smarter than I am.
Yes. Yeah. Don't worry. I'm as much an egotist as you are. Believe me.
Well, as long as you have a sense of humor about it and joke about it the way I just did.
Yeah.
People will forgive you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the truth.
Yeah. All right. Well, I feel like you and I can now jump in and talk about Elon Musk for the next half hour, but I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up. And thank you so much for being on the show. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin. My best to all of your listeners out there, who I also hope are readers.
I think the majority of them are. Well, we're going to put it to the test. But everyone listening, thank you for sticking around for the interview. I'm sure you enjoyed it as much as I did. And stick around for the wrap-up at the end, and I will see you all next week. Well, that was my interview with David Brin, sci-fi legend David Brin. I think... I am, I don't know, as time goes by with this show, I just stand sort of amazed. So, and I hope you enjoy all the guests that I bring to the show. I hope you enjoy everyone. And to me, they're all heroic. They're all people that I admire. They're all people that I feel I can learn something from. They come from all levels. You know, I've interviewed authors who are just starting out. They have one book. I've interviewed authors who haven't actually published the book they've written yet. All the way up to authors like Mr. Brin and Mr. Larry Niven and, you know, Andy Weir and those guys. I've talked to some pretty amazing authors on the show. And I've also talked to people who aren't authors, of course, because this show is about that story of humanity. And I'm really happy when I get someone like Mr. Brin on the show. But I'm equally happy with each and every one of my guests. This past, I don't know, it's been a couple of years now. In these past 100 episodes, I feel like I've gained so much just from being here. Just from... you know, sitting and chatting with these people, just sitting and having conversations about their work, about their passions, about their interpretation of the world around them. And sometimes we agree on things and sometimes we don't. And I think that is also key to how we learn and grow as humans. You know, if we agreed on everything, I don't think there would be any growth. Like story, like any good story, character growth is all about conflict. One of the rules of storytelling is to your character has to change from beginning to end, and in the story of our lives, that's absolutely the truth. That's who we are. That's why we resonate with stories. And so these past 100 episodes have been just completely amazing to me. I'm so honored that you are here, and I mean that. I'm just truly honored that you're here listening to me. You know, I'm sitting in my RV, which, you know, we live in full time now. We travel full time now. I'm looking out at a beautiful landscape here in Florida, Naples, Florida. Not a place I ever thought about visiting. Never even really, I think, fully grasped that it existed, honestly. I've heard of it, but I don't know. I never registered, but, you know, here we are. And, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday is coming up. Is a time to be, a time where we're reminded to be grateful. And there are a lot of tragedies in the world right now. There are a lot of people who are scared and worried. And you know, with the election, when this came up, you know, this came up in the interview. But whoever you may have supported or not supported, I know that there were a lot of people who were impacted by the election of Donald Trump. And I want to give a hopeful message about that, because I think, you know, I'm not a Trump fan. I was not a Clinton fan by any stretch, but I'm not a Trump fan either. And, you know, it concerns me, the attitudes and the policies that I hear about. But I have to live in a world of hope. I have to live in a world where the individual has the power to influence their lives and their environment. I have to live in that world. If I don't, there's no point for me here. So I want to bring that kind of hope to you, too. That's what these stories are all about. That's what it's about when I talk to David Brin. That's what it's about when I talk to Andy Weir. That's what it's about when I talk to, you know, any of the guests I've had on this show. It's about hope. And I hope that, ironically, that I am bringing you inspiration, that I'm somehow giving you the fuel you need to go out and make the most positive change in the world that you can make. That's my goal for the show. In 100 episodes, I've never varied from my goals here. I've always felt that this was a show that had the potential to reach every individual with the message that their story matters, that they are the very hope that they seek in the world. Now, I'm a Christian. And, you know, my hope is also in God. My faith is in God. But I think God built us. When it says that we were built in God's image, I think he built us as machines and instruments of hope. I think that's what we're here for, to love and build something good in the world. So, all that said, quick housekeeping for the show itself. If you are enjoying the show, I could very much use your support. And in that, one of the best ways is for you to go to iTunes and leave a review of the show. Rate the show at, you know, 4 or 5 stars. That's very helpful to me. If you would do that, it'll help other people discover the show. That's awesome, and I appreciate that. That alone is very helpful. You can do that on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, anywhere you find the Wordslinger Podcast. Just search for Wordslinger Podcast in your favorite, whatever storefront you prefer for finding your podcasts. Go in, find the show, give it some stars, and give it a nice review. And that will help me reach so many more people. I appreciate it. You can also support the show on Patreon. If you want to support financially, just go to wordslingerpodcast.com. There's a support the Wordslinger Podcast on Patreon button right there at the top right screen of the screen. You can actually, I think there's a Patreon. Yeah, there is a still, at the moment, there is a Patreon button on the menu bar itself. So if you would like to be a financial supporter of the show, I appreciate that. As always, I'm not it's not necessary per se, we'll say, but you know, there is a financial burden to producing the show, honestly. And if I can make the show self-sufficient, then that's even better. So those dollars are appreciated. I really can't thank you enough. The other way you can support the show, and I don't really mention this as a way of supporting the show that often, but I'm always open to hearing questions and comments. So if you will, there's 3 ways you can reach out to me here. Number one, call me at 281-809-WORD. That's 281-809-9673. You can leave me a voicemail. And sometimes it doesn't work, I've been told. My friend Roland Dizel pointed out that it didn't work, and I discovered that if I have Skype open when you call, it won't send you to voicemail. I am sorry about that. But if you call that number, most of the time, you're going to be able to leave me a voicemail. You can also send me a voicemail from the page itself at wordslingerpodcast.com. Click the Send Voicemail tab floating on the right-hand side of the screen. And that will allow you to record a voicemail that will be sent to me via email. And I can play those voicemails over the air, unless you say otherwise. You can also email me. If you go to wordslingerpodcast.com, click on Contact, then you can leave me a comment right there on the contact page. And I will also read those on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, or unless it doesn't, you know, warrant being read on the air. Sometimes people just say nice things and they don't always make the, you know, show. So, but if you'd like to hear yourself read on air or hear your voice on air, just, reach out. That's a great way to support the show too. It shows other people, it's social proof, we'll say. It shows other people that we actually have a listenership. It's encouraging to people. And sometimes you'll say things that will encourage someone and you had no idea. You know, it's bizarre how that works, actually. So, other than that, I think that pretty much wraps us up on housekeeping. But I really appreciate you sticking around for 100 episodes. The show is amazing to me. I'm so happy that I'm a part of this, and I'm so happy and honored that you deem it worthy and that you are listening. So I hope you've enjoyed these past 100 episodes. I hope you stick around for the next 100. And please let me know. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know what you're getting out of it. You can also contact me, by the way, on social media. At Kevin Tomlinson on Twitter is one way. Just search Kevin Tomlinson on any given social media platform. I promise you, if I'm on there, I took that name. So take care of yourselves out there. I know we're posting after the Thanksgiving holiday, but for those of you listening in the U.S. especially, but I hope you have a wonderful holiday, and I hope you're having a blessed season in your life. I know we've had a rough 2016, and it's almost wrapped up, but what I hope we'll take from this, what I want us to take from this entire year, is what are the good things that came to us We don't have to dwell on deaths and tragedies and disappointments. We can dwell on the good, and we can be grateful. So let me know what you're grateful for. I hope you enjoyed this episode with David Brin, and I hope you'll swing around this time next week for the next episode. And I give my love, give blessings to all of you. God bless, and I will see you next time.
Wordslinger.